get in your mazel tovs quickly because it's time to start. So we'll, on behalf of everybody, we'll officially give Shuli another mazel tov. You know, I announced all week, you know, you were missing last week's class because, you know, the wedding. So Baruch Hashem, for good reasons. And we want to wish the young couple, she'll build a Beit Ne'aman Yisrael, a beautiful Jewish home. And she'll be proud of all her children. All of us should have many occasions to come and celebrate. Okay. So part three, we're going to discuss the renegades, you know, the people who didn't like to celebrate with everybody else, want to make their own parties or miss parties. So Bakasha, the Karaites, it's all yours, Shuli.
Okay. Hi, everybody. So we are going this week. We've been jumping around a little in time and I apologize for that, but I know you're all very smart and we're going to go back and do a little timeline again. But this week, our focus is going to be on a few different things. First of all, in terms of place, we're going to be focused on Jerusalem. Okay. Last week, 2 weeks ago, we were in Tveria. Now we're going to be in Jerusalem, see what things were happening in Jerusalem more or less at the same time. We're still in the time period of the early Muslims before the Crusades. We're going to talk about a little bit about the conflict between Babylonia and the land of Israel, because that's an important thing that's happening at this time period where the Babylonian yeshivot are very significant and central. And there's a battle for primacy between them and the land of Israel. But mostly we're going to talk about the Karaites. Who are they? Why are they important? Why were they a major threat? Today, you talk about Karaites, it's more or less a curiosity. But there was a point where they were a real threat to rabbinic Judaism. And we're going to also talk about one of the great champions of rabbinic Judaism against the Karaites, and that is Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon, who we're going to see, was the first in absolutely everything. So let's dive in. The picture that you're looking at here is the interior of the Karaite synagogue in Jerusalem, which still exists today. And we'll come back to it and we'll talk about it. Some people may be familiar with it. In the heart of the Jewish quarter, and there is still a Karaite community in Jerusalem, as well as quite large Karaite communities in other parts of Israel, in Ramleh and Ashdod, but we'll get to that at the very end. But let's first, as we usually do, take a look at the timeline, okay, to understand where we are. Because we're going to Jerusalem, I wanted us to kind of take a long view of Jerusalem, because what's very significant about the Muslim conquest, certainly for Jews, is that Jews return to Jerusalem after being absent for a total of 500 years, with perhaps a few people sneaking in here and there. But essentially, official Jewish life in Jerusalem ends in the 130s, okay? Whether as a result of the Bar Kokhba revolt, as a catalyst for the Bar Kokhba revolt, we still have many questions about the Bar Kokhba revolt. But certainly in that beginning of the second century of the Common Era, Jerusalem becomes Judenrein. There are no more Jews. A new city is founded. The Romans call it Elia Capitolina. Tzion Sadeh Techerash Zion becomes a plowed field. Okay, the Temple Mount is plowed. We have a lot of sources about this idea and about Jerusalem being emptied of Jews. We're going to come back to that. Okay, so that's just to get us a little bit of an understanding of the longer view of Jerusalem, which is going to change with the Muslim conquest when Jews are allowed back. Okay, but before we get to that, we're going to be talking about the Geonim, okay, the heads of the yeshivot. If you know a little bit of history, Jewish literary history, so you know about the Tanaim, those are the teachers of the Mishnah, the Amoraim, the teachers of the Gemara, okay, there's another group called the Savoraim, we're not going to go into them, but then there are the Geonim. The Geonim are the leaders of the great yeshivot in Babylonia, as well as in Jerusalem, and that's in this early Muslim period, okay, 600 to 1000, this is the period where the Babylonian community is the center of Jewish life. Israel is always important, but the Babylonian community is where everything is really intellectually happening historically, and we're going to be talking about the Geonim. A huge change, a tsunami in the world is the beginning of Islam. Okay, 622, Muhammad comes out of Mecca and Medina, creates this new religion with a lot of it based in Judaism and Christianity, rather disappointed that the Jews are not interested in it, and ultimately murders many Jews in Arabia because of that, and then comes out, and really there's a scholar who uses that term, the Islamic tsunami, this incredibly quick conquest of much of the known world, and of course, including the land of Israel, including Jerusalem, okay, where Jews are now allowed back under certain restrictions. We're going to come back to all of this, so don't worry if you're, you know, if we didn't go into detail. Okay. The Temple Mount, okay, Har HaBayit, becomes very significant to the Muslims, as it was not to the Byzantine Christians. Okay, Haram al-Sharif, there's the Dome of the Rock, Al-Aqsa, that's built by the Umayyad Caliphs. We're going to talk about that. And then we have our beginnings of Karaism. Okay, sometime in the 8th century, how does it begin? Why does it begin? Who is Anan ben David? We're going to get to that. We have the Karaite community in Jerusalem. Okay. And we have our champion, Sajid Gaon, 882 to 942. Rav Sajid Gaon, even though I hated this movie, I'll still use the comparison. Rav Sajid Gaon is the Forrest Gump of his period. Okay. He is involved in anything that's happening in his time. He has a finger in it. He is involved in it. A calendar controversy. We'll get to that too. And all of this comes to a crashing end with what we talked about in the first class, right? The Crusader conquest of Jerusalem. We talked then about the Jewish community being destroyed, but the Karaite community is as well. The Jews ultimately return. The Karaites take much longer to return. But we are really going to talk about up until the Crusaders. And this is that first great wave of Muslim power of the early Muslims in the land of Israel. Okay, so that's just to give us a little bit of a larger picture. So let's go to Babylonia for a few minutes. Okay, like I said, the Jewish center at the time, but without one leader, but rather with many leaders. Now, Babylonia is a Jewish center. Babylonia has a Jewish community already from the exile from the first temple, okay? But it doesn't really hit its stride until we get to the time of the Amoraim, until we get to Rav and Shmuel, right? We're talking about the third century of the Common Era, okay? So we're going to talk about the rabbis and the Geonim, but we also have another leader who is already early on from the beginning of the community, and that is someone called the Exilarch, or in Aramaic, the Resh Galuta, the Rosh HaGalut, the head of the diaspora. Okay, the diaspora, of course, is Babylonia at this time. Now, there's a lot of legend and folklore about the Exilarch. First of all, and perhaps most importantly, he is supposed to be a descendant of the House of David, so he is, at least in Jewish terms, really royalty. And non-Jews also look at him and see him as the leader of the Jews. He's very powerful. He's recognized by the secular authorities, whether it's the Persians, the Sasanians, eventually the Muslims. We have this fabulous description from the 10th century by a chronicler named Nathan the Babylonian. And this is very famous. Some people may have seen it before. This is just one little piece where he talks about the installation of the new Resh Galuta, of the new Exilarch. Okay? The members of the two academies, led by the two heads, the Geonim, as well as by the leaders of the community, assemble in the house of an especially prominent man before the Shabbat on which the installation of the Exilarch is to take place. The first homage is paid on Thursday in the synagogue. The event being announced by trumpets, everyone sends presents to the Exilarch according to his means. The leaders of the community and the wealthy send handsome garments, jewelry, gold, and silver. On Thursday and Friday, the Exilarch gives great banquets, right? It's really like, you know, think of a presidential inauguration or a king being crowned. That's what's happening, at least according to Nathan, right? On the morning of the Shabbat, the nobles of the community call for him and accompany him to the synagogue. Here, a wooden platform covered entirely with costly cloth has been erected, under which a picked choir of sweet-voiced youths, well-versed in the liturgy, has been placed, et cetera, et cetera. The prayer, the Exilarch, who until now has been standing in a covered place, appears. The whole congregation rises and remains standing. The two Geonim have taken seats to his right and his left, each making an obeisance. Okay, so this is something that, at least in Jewish eyes, it is equivalent to a king, Right. He has a lot of power, and he's considered to be the head of the Jewish community by non-Jews. Now, one of the things that's very interesting, at least in the Gemara, is that the Reish Galuta doesn't always appear on the same, to be on the same page with the rabbis. Okay. Meaning, we have all these stories about rabbis who come to the house of the Reish Galuta, and are they following the law properly in terms of kashrut and Shabbat? Not so much necessarily. And the rabbis are very nervous because they don't want to, you know, cause trouble. They don't want to get in a conflict with the Reish Galuta, but they also don't want to, you know, not keep the law. So that's a very interesting take that the Gemara has, that the Reish Galuta might be very powerful, but he's not always necessarily the most learned or the most religious, right? So you can see a conflict already being set up there, okay? One other thing that's important to understand is that the secular authorities, at least the Muslims, view the exilarch as the head of the Jewish community, and there cannot be any other leader of the Jewish community. Otherwise, that's, you know, that's going against the exilarch. So if you purport to set yourself up as a new leader, you could get in great trouble. And that's going to be part of the Karaite story, at least according to the rabbis. Okay, but we'll come back to that. Now, the other authority, the more religious, the more scholarly authority, are the Geonim, are the heads of the academies of the yeshivot. Now, we have Talmudic academies in Babylonia, but of course we have in the land of Israel as well. So if you remember from last time, we talked about Tiberias, and Tiberias being the home of the Sanhedrin and the continuation of the tradition of the Masorah. So that's where you have what's called Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael, the yeshiva of the land of Israel. And this picture here on the left is an inscription, a mosaic that was found in Tiberias from a synagogue. Was it from a yeshiva? We don't know. But that's Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael, which is the leading halachic authority in the land of Israel, since Jerusalem and in the Byzantine times is not, there are no Jews living there. And even in the Muslim times, it's a small community. The primary community is in Tveria. Okay. Now, what's happening in Babylonia is you have a few different yeshivot. Let's take, let's annotate a little. And you'll see, one second, sorry, get my colors. Okay, so we have a few. We're going to talk about the three major ones, which are Pumbedita, Neharda, and Sura. You have other places that we hear about in the Gemara, Mechoza, Mata, Machasia, but these are where the yeshivot are. The very first one is in Neharda, which is begun by the Amora Shmuel. Rav comes back from the land of Israel. He starts another yeshiva a little further south in Sura. And by the way, you'll notice that all of these are along the rivers because that's where people lived, right? That's where the Jewish communities were, along the rivers, the Prat and the Chidekel. The Euphrates and the, why am I blanking on the Chidekel? Well, you guys know what it is. Okay.
Tigris.
Tigris. Thank you. I knew somebody would know. Okay. So here are our yeshivot, each one, more important at different times. The question that you're probably asking yourself is, why are they called Geonim? Today, when you say someone is a Gaon, right? There was a commercial in Israel a few years ago for Materna baby formula, and the tagline was, Mi Gaon Chel Ima, right? Who's the genius? Who's mommy's genius? Which is what, you know, all Jewish mothers say. So we think of Gaon as a genius, but that's not the origin of the word. The origin of the word is Rosh Yeshivat Geon Yaakov. These yeshivot were called Geon Yaakov, right? Which comes from a verse in the book of Psalms in Tehillim. Yibchar lanu et nachlatenu et Geon Yaakov asher ahev sela. So the yeshivot were called Geon Yaakov, and therefore the head of the yeshiva was called a Gaon. Now, as you can see, right, you have these many yeshivot in Babylonia, many, many great scholars there, both in the time of the Gemara and afterwards. But you have a fascinating conflict that develops, that always is, ever since there is a diaspora, between the land of Israel and Babylonia. Because while you might have these brilliant scholars and teachers in Babylonia, the land of Israel is always the land of Israel, right? We've talked about this. We talked about this last week. That you can't take away from the power of the land of Israel. even if the greatest scholars are in Babylonia. We're going to see that's going to come to a fore when we talk about the calendar and the controversy over the calendar and who gets to establish leap years, new months, right? All the different things about the calendar. But in Babylonia, you have this strong tradition of study. Okay? It becomes a true Torah center. And it's not only for the elite, meaning the people who go to yeshiva full time, the rabbis, the teachers who teach there full time. Yes, they are the elite. But you have this tradition which begins already in the time of the Gemara. And it continues certainly through the time of the Gaonim, something that's called Yarchei Kala, right? The months of the bride. What's Yarchei Kala? These are 2 months in the year, and we have a description of it already in the Tanhuma. God has appointed the two academies for the good of Israel. In them, day and night are devoted to the study of Torah. To there come scholars from all places twice a year in Adar and Elul and associate with one another in discussions on the Torah. Now, this Yarchei Kala, which begins in Babylonia, continues in other places. In fact, it's still done in some places today. I know that they don't do it for a month, but I know that like the OU has had Yarchei Kala. The idea is that you have people who are busy making a living, right? They don't necessarily have time to devote themselves full time to Torah study. They'll learn a little bit every day, do a little daf yomi, but you want to spend some intense time learning. So you set aside time. Now, why these particular months? Why Adar and Elul? So you could say, on a Jewish cycle, right? Adar is right before Pesach. Elul is right before Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. These are times where you want to immerse yourself in Torah. That's true. But at a practical level, if you're a farmer, which most people were, these are quiet times, right? Adar, your planting is finished. You're waiting, maybe with trepidation, for the harvest. Okay. Elul, the same thing, right? The harvest of the fruits, which is happening, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, but there's not that much work for you to do in Elul, right? In Adar, you finished your planting. In Elul, you finished gathering your grain and you're waiting to gather your fruit. So you have some free time. You have some downtime, right? If you're an accountant, this is May for you, right? You have a little time to breathe. And then what do you do with that time? You come and you learn Torah. One of the most enduring examples that we have of how important these yeshivot were is that we still pray for them in our davening on Shabbos, even though these yeshivot have not been around for quite a long time. And I'm sure most of you are familiar with the Yikum Purkan, right? This is one of the prayers that we say as we are finishing the Torah reading for Shabbat, as we're getting ready to put the Torah away. We say this prayer that there should be strength from heavens, right? For who? Okay, take a look over here. Let's annotate it so we can just draw out what we need. Okay, Lemaranan v'Rabanan Chavruta Kadishata Di Be'aradi Yisrael Udi Le'Bibavel L'Reshe Kala U'L'Reshe Galuta U'L'Reshe Mitivata U'L'Dayanai Debava. Okay, so if your Aramaic is not up to snuff, okay, the rabbis and the teachers, the holy community who is in the land of Israel and in Babylonia, the heads of the Kala, the Exilarch, the heads of the yeshivot, the judges in the courts. Hey, we are praying for all of them. We haven't had yeshivot and exilarchs in give or take 1,000 years. That's okay. We're still praying for them. And we're still praying for them actually in Aramaic, right? Which was the language, of course, that they were using. So I think that's a fascinating testimony to what's going on. So that's our yeshivot and this important center in Bavel. And we're going to come back to it when we get to the story of the calendar. But now let's go to Jerusalem. Okay. So Jerusalem, thriving Jewish city, of course, in First Temple times, in Second Temple times. The destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70 is a terrible blow, but it does not put an end, it seems, to a Jewish community in Jerusalem. It's devastated. Many people are killed or imprisoned, but the community comes back. But what does really put an end to Jewish life in Jerusalem, and this is why this is arguably a greater tragedy than the destruction of the temple, is the story of the Bar Kokhba revolt. Right, with the Bar Kokhba revolt, 132 to 135, the Jews are roundly defeated by the Romans. And at that point, the Romans have had enough with the Jews and with their crazy rebellions and with their allegiance to rebuilding the temple. They're sick of these guys. And therefore, they say, that's it. No more coming back to Jerusalem. with the hope that if they can erase Jerusalem from Jewish consciousness, then the Jews will become docile, nice citizens of the Roman Empire, and everybody will be happy. As we all know, that does not happen. Jews are not normally very docile and do not get erased very quickly. And Jerusalem changes from what we'll call earthly Jerusalem, Yushalayim Shalmata, to heavenly Jerusalem, Yushalayim Shalmala. Jerusalem retains its significance in prayer and in prayer direction and in learning and in talking about it. But instead of it being an earthly Jerusalem that you can go and visit three times a year, now it's something that we talk about and we dream about. Right? And even though the Romans erased the name of Jerusalem, we're going to see in a second, Jews never change the name, right? And always called it Jerusalem. But in a practical sense, on earth, Yerushalayim Shalmata, in the earthly Jerusalem, there are no Jews, right? So I brought you this picture, this mural, which is today in the rebuilt Cardo in the Jewish quarter. It's a great picture, right? And it shows the Cardo, right? The central north-south street that runs through the city. This is a major street in Roman times, mostly in Byzantine times. And all sorts of people from all over the world and merchants and goods, and the economy is thriving, but no Jews, right? No Jews. Jews are not allowed into Jerusalem. And we have this testimony, this very, very harsh and nasty testimony by Jerome, right? A priest, a church father, Jerome, Hieronymus in Greek and in Latin. And he writes in his commentary, he writes a biblical commentary. Jerome, as much as he hated Jews, actually was very interested in Hebrew and studied Hebrew and probably with Jews, and wrote a commentary to Tanakh. And in his commentary on the book of Zephaniah, he writes about what is happening with the Jews in Jerusalem. Until today, it has been forbidden for those poisonous hypocrites, that's us, to enter Jerusalem because of their murder of the prophets, including the last one, the Son of God. They may come only to cry, because then they are permitted to mourn the ruins of the city in exchange for payment. Just as they once bought the blood of the Messiah, now they buy their own tears, and even mourning is not given them for free. So this is something that we didn't know about from the Romans. We knew from the Romans writers that Jews are not allowed into Jerusalem, but Jerome adds that they are allowed to pay money and to come to Jerusalem when, one day a year, which day? On the day that the Romans conquered and destroyed Jerusalem, i.e. Tisha B'Av. You can see the members of this nation, women wearing rags, old men carrying a burden of rags and years, gathering to mourn and proving by their bodies and their clothes the meaning of the anger of the Lord, right? Very important idea in Christian theology that Jews are witnesses to what happens to people who reject the truth of Christianity. A collection of miserable rabble appears while the cross of the Lord shines and celebrates his resurrection, and on the Mount of Olives is raised a cross. Meanwhile, this pathetic nation cries over its destroyed temple, and they are not worthy of pity. So Jerusalem has no Jews except on Tisha B'Av. The city is transformed. Okay? The Romans, after the Bar Kokhba revolt, or perhaps before, and then they develop it more, make a new city that they call Elia Capitolina, after the Capitoline gods. Okay? Its center is no longer the area of the Temple Mount, because for the Romans, the Temple Mount is not important at all, right? It's only important in order to erase what was there. And that's why they put up pagan statues there. But they move the center, what the main street had been in temple times, which is right near the Temple Mount, that is erased. And instead, they move the center to this Cardo that we saw in the picture, right? Starting but at what we call today Damascus Gate, okay? Going down this main street with other streets off of side streets. What's fascinating, by the way, is that this architecture, this urban planning that the Romans create already in the second, third century of the Common Era is still the urban planning of Jerusalem. The streets are still the same. They're based on that Roman plan. When the Roman Empire becomes Christian, when we talk about the Byzantines, then the city moves from being a pagan city, right, with pagan temples, Temple of Jupiter, statues on the Temple Mount, to becoming a very Christian city, right? And this place where the Temple of Jupiter was becomes the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, but you have many other churches all around, as well as many churches on the Mount of Olives over here, lots of processions, lots of Christian pilgrims. The city becomes a very significant Christian city. And like I said, for Jews, it kind of fades into memory. It's important, but it is not the place that they are able to physically visit. Right? But that is going to come to a change with this incredible moment in human history, right? Definitely one of the top 10 in terms of how human history has changed. And that's the beginnings of Islam, okay? Muhammad begins to preach his new religion. If you look at this map, it's a great map, okay? The darkest brown is the very beginnings of the caliphate of Islam, right? Muhammad begins in Arabia, and throughout his lifetime, this is really where the conquests are. But then the next 30 years, 632 to 661, you have this expansion into Asia Minor, what we would call Turkey today, right? The land of Israel, Egypt, part of North Africa, and then with the Umayyads, 661 to 750, even further, right? Expanding all the way across North Africa, all the way to Spain, further into the east. So it's really an unbelievable, unbelievable conquest that happens with lightning speed, right? Muhammad begins to preach his religion first in Medina, where the Jewish community, like I said, they are not particularly interested in Muhammad's new ideas, and he is displeased, and the Jewish community is killed and their property is taken. Then we go to Mecca. Okay. And then throughout much of the world. Now, this is fueled obviously by religious fervor. Okay. One of the principles of Islam is jihad, is holy war, meaning you need to bring the world to Islam. Okay. And the world is either Dar al-Islam, the house of Islam, right? The house of submission, the house of the belief in this new religion, or it is Dar al-Kharb, the house of the sword. Okay? If you're not in the Dar al-Islam, you are going to be put to the sword, with the very important exceptions, which we talked about last time, of these dhimmi, of these people of the book, Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians, who are allowed elements of religious freedom under many restrictions. Okay. But you have this idea of religious war bringing the world to Islam, as well as more kind of mundane base motives, money, land, conquest, right? Many, many, many converts to this new religion. Among them, by the way, Jews, right? When Islam sweeps through the land of Israel, there are quite a few people who, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. And there's actually a fascinating theory. There are Muslims in the land of Israel today, particularly in the southern Hebron Hills, who are called the Mechamrim. Mechamrim means chaymar is wine, right? It means they drink wine. Muslims don't drink wine. Hey, this was a small group of Muslims who did things kind of differently. Okay, they drink wine. They have some kind of candle lighting in the winter time around Hanukkah, right? This was a phenomenon that was studied by Yitzhak Ben Tzvi in the early part of the 20th century. And the suggestion is that these are kind of Moranos. These were kind of hidden Jews. They converted to Islam, but they kept some of their Jewish ideas. And there are people who go even further, who say that many, many of the Muslims who are in the land of Israel today are descendants of Jews. I don't know if we're going to go that far, but it is a fascinating idea. But what has the greatest significance perhaps for Jews is that they are allowed to return to Jerusalem. Like we said last time, the Pact of Omar, lots of different restrictions, right? But we do have permission. Now, Jews, whenever there's any kind of major world conflict, Jews tend to look at it and say, oh, this is the footsteps of the Messiah, right? The redemption is coming. This happens in the Crusades and the Napoleonic Wars and many, many times. Jews look at this and the same thing here, right? This battle between the Christians of the Byzantine Empire and the Muslims of the Caliphate, Jews look at it and say, oh, maybe redemption is coming. And adding to that is the fact that they are allowed back into the city. Now, we know that they're allowed back because we have this letter that was found in the Cairo Geniza. Now, it's a problematic letter because we don't know who wrote it and we don't know when it's from. But we do have a great description here of what happens when the conqueror of the city, the Muslim conqueror, Omar, comes into the city. And I just excerpted a few pieces for you. I didn't bring the whole thing. All the Muslims in the city and surrounding came together with a group of Jews. They were ordered to sweep the site of the temple and clean it. Okay, this is a fascinating thing. As far as we know, even though scholarship is changing today, the Byzantines ignored the Temple Mount. They were the only group that were not interested in it. Although some people say today that perhaps they built a church there. We don't have enough evidence yet to say, but it seems that the Temple Mount becomes something of a garbage heap. Now, the Muslims come, and at least according to this letter, understand that there's some significance to this site. They ask the Jews, you know, where is this holy site? And then they ask him to clean it, ask them to clean it from the garbage. Whenever they uncovered another layer, Omar would ask the elders of the Jews if this was the stone known as the foundation stone. Okay, now, is this correct? Did Omar really know all this? Is this imputed to him? Like I said, we really don't know. But it's significant because the Jews see the Muslims as giving importance to this place, the place that's holy to the Jews. And then after this whole situation happens, we'll talk about the Temple Mount in a minute, the Jews gathered before Omar and said to him, how many of the community of Jews will the Emir of the believers command to come to the city? And then we have an interesting back and forth. I took it out for you, but the Jews say, oh, we want 200 families, right? And the Christians say, what are you talking about? We only want 50 families. Back and forth, right? A whole bargaining. Omar decreed that 70 households should come. So 70 households, including women and children, moved from Tiberias, right? Remember, that's the center, and established settlements in buildings whose foundations had stood many generations. Okay, so the Muslim conquest of Jerusalem, 638 CE, and Jews at that point are allowed to return. Now, where do they return to? Okay, so the sources that we have suggest that it's in the south of the city, not necessarily in the traditional Jewish quarter that we talk about today, although perhaps, right? Some people say maybe Mount Zion, and then there's also suggestions that it's here, right? By the southern wall of the Temple Mount, by what we call the Huldah Gates, right? People may have been to the excavations there. We don't have so much archaeological proof of what the Jewish households might have looked like, but that's the suggestion that it was in the south of the city. Later on, right before the Crusades, we know the Jews move, they are moved by the Muslims to the northern part of the city, right? The northern part of the city where today it's the Muslim quarter, the Jews are moved to there. But in the beginning, it seems they're in the south, right? Now, Islam's holiest cities are Mecca and Medina, but they start to attribute holiness to Jerusalem as well. Okay, Jerusalem is no longer Elia Capitolina. It gets its new name, okay, either Al-Quds, the holy city, or Beit al-Makdish, which is, of course, Beit HaMikdash, right, the city of the temple. Okay, they take this Temple Mount, right? We all know this very, very famous view, right? They take this Temple Mount and erect on it two significant buildings, the Dome, well, many significant buildings, but the two major ones are the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Why, right? Why is this an important place? What becomes significant to the Muslims? So we hear about Omar, right, who wants to know about the Temple Mount and where is the foundation stone. And what happens is that a surah in the Quran that talks about Muhammad making a very significant journey is attributed very early on to Jerusalem, right? So let's read the actual text, and then we'll talk about the interpretations of it. Glory to him who made his servant travel by night, right, night journey, from the sacred place of worship to the furthest place of worship, whose surroundings we have blessed to show him some of our signs. He alone is the all-hearing, the all-seeing, right? So you can see that in the original text, we don't have any places, but very early on, the oral law of the Muslims, the hadith, right, says the sacred place of worship, that's the Kaaba in Mecca. The furthest place, Al-Aqsa, the Katseh, the edge, right? That's where the name of the mosque comes from. The furthest place, that's Jerusalem. Okay. And this night journey, Muhammad comes at night. And he comes to on his horse, Al-Burak, right? Lightning, the lightning steed. He ties him to the wall of the Temple Mount. And there's actually holes in the wall that are attributed to the place, you know, a hole that's a place where he ties the horse, right? The rock, right? What Jews call the foundation stone, the Evan Hashtiyah, which is the rock under the dome of the rock, right? That Muslims believe is the place from which Muhammad ascends to heaven for 40 days, right? Obvious parallel to Moses, goes up to heaven for 40 days, spends time with God, right? This is a depiction, one of the depictions of the night journey, and centers it happening in Jerusalem, right? Now, there's nothing that's built here yet, right? Until the Omar cleans it off, but until the next dynasty, the Umayyads come along, and they are the ones who build. This is a caliph called Abd al-Malik. Okay? He builds the Dome of the Rock. There was already a small mosque here. He adds to it and makes Al-Aqsa, and this becomes a very significant place. It is not it's not the number one place, but it becomes a very important place. Now, the question is why, right? So you have religious traditions, of course, but you also have the fact that the Umayyads, this dynasty, are based not in Arabia, but they are based in Damascus, which is not so far away from Jerusalem. Maybe they want a center, a religious center that's a little closer to them. But whatever it is, already very early on from the 7th century, the Muslims see Jerusalem as a holy place, as a significant place. And that, of course, has implications for Jews, both good and bad. Okay? Jews are allowed back in the city. They're allowed onto the Temple Mount. They actually, we have a text that talks about how they are the ones who are given the job of cleaning the Temple Mount, which is fascinating, right? On a regular basis, the maintenance of the Temple Mount. And we know that in these early Muslim days, the main synagogue of Jerusalem was in a cave underneath the Temple Mount. If you go on the Western Wall Tunnel tour, you'll see this cave, right? It's a cave. That's where the ancient synagogue was in early Muslim times. So very fascinating. Obviously, it's a double-edged sword. Certainly, we see that today. But in early Muslim period, it was something that was very, very important and very good for Jews. Let's take whoever's not muted, please mute themselves. Let's take a shift, right? Now for something completely different. Let's talk a little about the Karaites, right? We said that's another one of our important focal points for today. So the Karaites, who are also called the B'nai Mikra, already in their name, you can see that they are focusing on the Mikra, on the text. We'll talk about that in a second. We have two very different origin stories, which is not particularly surprising, right? Every breakaway group has their origin story. We're the real ones. We're the true Jews, Christians, Muslims, whatever. And the main group says, huh, are you talking about these guys are complete heretics? We have the same story with the Samaritans, and we have the story with the Tzedukim, right? We have this with the Karaites. We have the Rabbinite, or for to make life easier, we'll just call it the Jewish version of the story. In various places, I brought you one from Avraham ibn Daud, right? Sefer HaKabbalah, Avraham ben David, important scholar who writes this history book, basically, Sefer HaKabbalah. And he tells us about Anan, right? Anan ben David, the founder. Anan and Saul, his son, may the name of the wicked rot, lived in the days of Yehudai Gaon in Surah 760-764. This Anan was a descendant of the house of David and a scholar originally, but people discovered something wrong in him, and for this reason he was not appointed Gaon. And the faith decreed he should not become exilarch either. Because of the envy and chagrin in his heart, he enticed the Jews away from the traditions of the sages, composed books, and raised disciples, and of his own accord devised statues that are no good. Right? Classic story. A very bright young man, overlooked for leadership, all kinds of leadership, right? He's not made the exilarch, he's not made the Gaon. And in his pique and his anger and his jealousy, he breaks away and creates his own group, completely for his own selfish reasons, right? That's Avraham ibn Daud's version. That is the classic Jewish version. The Karaites obviously have a very different story. I brought you a source here from the 18th century, but it's based on much earlier sources. Anan of blessed memory lived in Baghdad and belonged to the party of the Tzaddikim. Okay, tzaddikim, righteous ones, also perhaps similar to tzedukim. We're going to talk about that in a second. Okay, because of his great wisdom, the whole house of Israel chose him to be president of the court and exarch, right? This is a totally different story. He was chosen. Anan desired to restore the crown of the law to its pristine glory and began to preach in public and to argue against the oral law of the Mishnah, to deny it and repudiate it completely. Because of that, people get angry at him. Anan rose and took with him his sons and disciples. They went to Jerusalem, the holy city, and settled there. There he built a synagogue. All right, does he really come? Maybe, maybe not. Both of these sources agree that Anan is the one who starts this group. Okay? They both agree that he creates different laws than we have already. What is the reason behind it? That we don't know. Okay. But he creates this breakaway group, this breakaway sect, which it seems is denying the Torah Sheba'al Peh, denying the oral law of the rabbis. Now, a lot of people get confused, and rightfully so, between the Karaites and the Samaritans and the Essenes, right, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Sadducees, the Tzedukim, we mentioned before. What's the deal, right? All of these different groups had issues with the Torah Sheba'al Peh, with the oral law and the traditions of the rabbis. Are they connected in some way? They all have very different origin stories. Hey, they come from very different places. And some people like to say, oh, none of them have an oral law, right? They don't have a Torah Sheba'al Peh. I will repeat to you something that I learned many, many years ago from a wonderful professor, David Weiss Halivni in Columbia. He says it's impossible not to have an oral law. There always is an oral law. You may not agree with the rabbi's oral law, but you have your own oral law. And he gave a wonderful example to illustrate this, right? Moses comes down from Mount Sinai. He starts reading out the Ten Commandments. He says, Lo tirtzach, don't kill. It's pretty clear, right? Don't kill. Okay, don't kill. Suddenly, some guy in the back raises his hand. What about in self-defense? Another guy raises his hand. What about a judge who, you know, executes someone? There's always a need for interpretation. The question is, do you accept the interpretation that we know today as the Mishnah, the Gemara? We know certainly in the time of the Second Temple, you had many groups who did not accept that interpretation. The question that scholars have been asking for a long time, certainly since the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, are these groups in any way connected, right? Was there some ancient tradition that one passed on to the other? It's a very interesting question. We don't have any proof one way or another. One very fascinating testimony is that perhaps the Karaites may have seen one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Why do we say this? Because we know that a Christian priest, a Nestorian priest in the early 9th century, writes about a cave near Jericho that was discovered and had scrolls in it. Did the Karaites in Jerusalem maybe see these scrolls, right? Another fascinating thing, in the Cairo Geniza, long before the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, they discovered a copy of what we now know today to be the Damascus Covenant, one of the major texts of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Could the Karaites have brought it to Cairo? Is there some connection? It's a very interesting question. There are some similarities. There are some similar terms, some similar ideas, but ultimately the ground from which all of these groups grew, each one is very, very different. And in terms of halakha, certainly between the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Karaites, very, very different. The people of the Dead Sea Scrolls have their own calendar, a solar calendar. The Karaites follow the same lunar calendar, lunisolar calendar that the Jews do. And the people of Dead Sea Scrolls wore tefillin. Tefillin was very important to them. We found it in the excavations in Qumran. The Karaites reject the idea of tefillin. So it's a very interesting suggestion. So far, we have no proof for it. What is the essence of this idea, right? So attributed to Anan, although it might be that it was written down later, is this phrase that you have here. Search well in the Torah and do not rely on my opinion. Meaning everyone is responsible to read the text for him or herself and to figure out the law for him or herself. Now, as you can imagine, this led to many, many variations in the law. Karaism in the time of Anan, at least, is very diffuse. Okay? It becomes more consolidated in the 9th century with one of the greatest Karaite scholars, Benjamin Nahawendi. one of the things that's very interesting about the Karaites, as opposed to, let's say, the people of the Dead Sea Scrolls, is that many of their beliefs are not different from rabbinic beliefs. Okay? They have a belief in the one God. They believe in the afterlife. They believe in reward and punishment. Where do they differ? They differ in their practical observance of the mitzvot. So we're going to take a look at a few different examples. And you can definitely hear what they're saying when they say, well, this is really the way the text should be interpreted. So for example, right, al mezuzot beitecha, right, you should have the Torah on the doorposts of your house, which rabbinic Jews interpret as write little scrolls, stick them inside a case, and put them on the doorposts. Karaites say, don't be so literal. It's a metaphor. Torah should be in your house, right? And what they do is kind of as a concession to show that they're Jews, they make this nice little tablet of the Ten Commandments, and they put that on top of their house. But that it should be on the doorpost of your house, that's a metaphorical idea. You don't need to actually write things and put them on the doorposts of your house. We're going to see something similar with tefillin. Okay. Another great example, tzitzit, right? And if you're interested in this, by the way, I'm always hesitant to encourage being interested in it because, you know, it's a problem not to believe in Torah Shebaal Peh, but it is fascinating. But if you're interested in this, by the way, and you come to Jerusalem, in the Karaite synagogue, right next door to the Karaite synagogue, there is a family, a Karaite family that lives there, and they have renewed, they have created a beautiful museum with traditions of the Karaites. So here's another example, tzitzit, right? Tzitzit, you have to have fringes on your garment, and you have to have a ptil tchelet, right? A blue fringe. In the time of the Mishnah in the time of the Gemara, there is extensive discussion as to what this tchelet is. And it has to be a very specific dye made in a very specific way. And it has to be color fast, et cetera, et cetera. Some people might know about this and know that for many years, Jews did not wear tchelet because they didn't know how to make this particular dye. And only in the last few decades have they started, you know, figuring out this technique again. Karaites say, what are you talking about? Tchelet is just a color. You don't need it to be made out of any particular type of dye of anything else. It can be a nice synthetic bright blue dye, and then you've fulfilled the commandment. So that's the Karaite tzitzit. Prayer. Now, prayer is very interesting as well. Okay, first of all of their prayers, if you think of Jewish prayers, we have prayers that come from Tanakh, like Tehillim, but we have prayers that are written later by Ezra, by the rabbis, right? Best example is the Amidah, is the Shemoneh Esrei. Hey, Karaite's prayers come from the Tanakh, right? Primarily Sefer Tehillim. So they'll say Shema, which appears in the Torah, but they won't say Shemoneh Esrei, which does not appear in the Torah. Hey, now, if you look at the picture, it's a great website about the Karaites, right? So they show you Karaite prayer. And you look at it, you say, oh, that looks very Muslim, right? They're prostrating themselves on the floor. Karaite synagogues do not have seats, right? You're not supposed to sit. And in the synagogue, you can prostrate yourself. And there are rugs on the floor, and you look at it and say, that looks very Muslim, the rugs, the lying down on the floor. But the truth is that it's not Muslim. It may have been influenced because Karaism arises during the heyday of Islam, but it actually is a very old Jewish practice. You go back to the temple, right? In the temple, you don't wear shoes, you don't sit down, you prostrate yourself. We hear about the Kohanim, right? Throwing themselves down on the floor. So these are ideas that the Karaites have brought back into what they do. They go back to the temple. They see the synagogue as a mini temple, right? What we call a mikdash ma'at, to the extent that you have to be clean when you enter it. What does that mean? We'll come to it in a minute. Okay, calendar. They follow the same calendar that rabbinites do. Okay, they have the same 19-year cycle of leap years. However, it's not always the same years. Okay, they also rely on sightings of the moon, which rabbinite Jews have not done for many centuries. One of the very interesting things they do that we know was done in the time of the Gemara is how do they determine when there should be a leap year? They go out to the fields, and that's the picture you have here on the right, and they see if the barley is ripe, okay? In the month of Adar, you go out and you see, is the barley getting ripe? Why? Because barley that is ripe is called aviv, That's actually what it means. If you look in the book of Exodus, where it talks about the plague of hail, of barad, and it says the barley is harmed because ha-se'ora aviv. It was already hard and ripe, and it's harmed by the hail. But the other growths were not harmed because they weren't really grown yet. So they want to see that the barley is in this state because we have to have Pesach Bechodesh ha'aviv, in the month when the barley is ripe. So they actually will go out and look at the barley and in that way determine if you need to add another month as opposed to rabbinite Jews who just have it kind of fixed in the calendar. You have certain customs that are very clearly different from rabbinite customs. I just brought you a few examples. I think one of the most famous ones, why did I bring you this picture of this yummy, delicious cholent? Not because it's Thursday night, but because one of the most famous customs that Karaites or laws that Karaites do not hold by is having a fire on Shabbat, right? When you look in the Torah, it says, Lo tivaru esh b'chomot shvoteham. You should not kindle a fire on Shabbat. Okay, Rabbinite Jews read that and they say, kindle. You shouldn't start a fire on Shabbat, but a fire that started before Shabbat, that's fine. It can just stay burning. The Karaite saying, no. No fire before, no fire during, no fire, period. That's it. So the majority of Karaites do not have electricity and heating and hot food on Shabbat. There are differences of opinions, but that's the majority. And because of that, Rabbinite Jews eat cholent, not just because cholent is tasty, but because and convenient on Shabbat, but because it's a statement to make against the Karaites. You think we can't have hot food? We're going to have hot food because hot food is what you do on Shabbat, right? So that's one very famous example. Another less famous, but very important is tefillin, right? That's the picture, of course, on the left here. Same thing like the mezuzah. Ba'ayu l'totafot al yadecha, right? B'nei necha. That it should always be on your heart, on your head, meaning this is a metaphorical idea. God should always be with you. The Torah should always be with you. No, it's not a black box that you tie around your head. It's a metaphor. Now, a fascinating thing is that some of the commentaries, the ones who are really into Pshuto Shel Mikra, into the plain sense of the text, are kind of inclined to believe that too. Not that they didn't wear tefillin, but they say if you're looking at the text in a really, you know, literal way, that seems to be what it means. And the most famous one is the Rashbam. The Rashbam is Rashi's grandson. And he writes on the Pasuk in Shmot that talks about tefillin, Lefi omek pshuto, the deep literal meaning, Yelacha halacha lezikaron tamid ki ilu katuva yadecha. You should always have the law remembering, you know, in front of you always as if it was written on your arm. Does the Rashbam not wear tefillin? Of course he wears tefillin. But does he believe that you could interpret the verse in a more literal way? Yes. Why is the Rashbam not afraid to write this? Because there are no Karaites in northern France. Okay, he's not threatened by the Karaites, as other commentaries who are also Pashtunim, literal, like the Ibn Ezra, they're not going to say this, but the Rashbam is able to say it. Okay, another distinction between the Rabbanites and the Karaites. Okay, they do not believe in mikvah. Okay, we have a nice mikvah. When the Torah says to become tahor, to purify yourself, to cleanse yourself, any water is good. You can take a shower, right? And that's why when they go to synagogue, you have to be clean, but you don't have to go to the mikvah because they don't see a need to go to the mikvah. Another fascinating one is Hanukkah, right? Hanukkah is a completely rabbinic holiday. It takes place after the end of the story of Tanakh. It's instituted by the rabbis. They celebrate Purim because Purim is still in Tanakh, right? Megillat Esther, but Hanukkah is not. Now, Karaites in Israel, by the way, will still eat sufganiyot and probably light candles too, because it's a cultural thing, right? But it's not something that they believe is a holiday because it's instituted by the rabbis and they're not holding by that. Now, one of the most positive things, beautiful things about the Karaites is their connection to Jerusalem. They call one of their names was Avelei Tzion, the mourners of Zion. Now we see they have a tradition that their synagogue is already founded by Anan in the 8th century. probably founded a little bit later, but it's definitely one of the oldest buildings in the Old City. And one of the very famous Karaite writers, Daniel Al-Khumisi, in the 9th century, he comes and he lives in Jerusalem, and he writes this great text, which I'm not going to read right now because I have other things I want to get through, but you have it for you to read by yourself, right? But just read the very beginning. You should know it's the villains of Israel who say we are not obliged to go to Jerusalem until he gathers us just as he has scattered us. Even if God had not commanded us to go to Jerusalem, we would never know by virtue of our own intelligence that there is an obligation upon all those who suffered from God's anger to come to supplicate him, right? And it is a responsibility of all Jews, i.e. all Karaites, to come and to live in Jerusalem. And they mourn for Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is a very significant place for all Jews, but for Karaites in particular, and they create this community that exists, like we said, until the time of the Crusaders. Where is their community? So we have testimony that it's not where the Jews lived, but rather kind of lower down in the southern part of the city in the Kidron Valley, which is what you see here. They have their own cemetery, which still exists today, by the way, and it's sadly very, very neglected, also down in the Kidron Valley. The community grows and it becomes very powerful. And in the 9th, 10th century, particularly in Egypt and in Babylonia and in the land of Israel, it's a very powerful community, and it's a threat to Rabbinite Jews because the ideas that they're espousing seem very logical and a lot of people are drawn to them, even though, by the way, they're usually more strict than Rabbinites. You have intermarriages between Karaites and Rabbinites. We know that because we have ketubas in the Cairo Geniza between the two groups, right? And we even have ketubas that talk about a Karaite woman marrying a Rabbinite man and putting into the ketubah that she gets to continue her Karaite customs after marriage, okay? And Jews are threatened by this. Who comes along to champion rabbinic law and Torah Shebaal Peh? Rav Sadia Gaon, right? And he is known, Rav Sadia Gaon is known as the ultimate first. Okay, so we'll do a little of his biography and then we'll talk about him and the Karaites. So he's born in Egypt in 882. Very, very learned, even as a very young man. He's already writing books. At some point, he leaves Egypt and he lives in Tiberias. We don't know for how long, what, where, but we know that he's been there. He continues on to Aleppo and ultimately comes to Baghdad. And in 922, he's in Babylonia. He's appointed the Rosh Yeshiva of Pumbedita. Okay, 928, he's appointed the Rosh Yeshiva of Sura, which was one of the greatest of the yeshivot, had fallen on hard times. He brings it back to life. He fundraises. He brings a lot of prestige. And it's fascinating that he's chosen, by the way, because Babylonian Jewry was a very hierarchical society, right? You had to be from the right families and the right connections. And often the head of the yeshiva is the son of the previous head of the yeshiva. Rav Sadia Gaon comes from nothing, from nowhere. Nobody knows anything about him. He's very, very strong and opinionated. And yet, despite those, deficiencies, he's chosen to be the Rosh Yeshiva. He is first in everything. He writes the first translation of the Tanakh into Arabic. He writes the first halachic works by subject, right, as opposed to just following the order of the Mishnah. He writes the first Hebrew-Arabic dictionary, right? He compiles the first Sidur. He is the first person, this is one of his most famous books, Sefer and Munot V'Deot, he is the first one to try to reconcile Torah and Greek philosophy. Hey, he's a grammarian. He's a Python. He's an astronomer. He's brilliant. Okay. And he really is the first in everything. The fact that we don't talk about him so much is because he was too successful, right? His firsts led to many others entering the field and ultimately eclipsing him. But being the first really changed Judaism in many ways. And of course, he takes on the Karaites. One of the great challenges of Rav Sadia Gaon's life are the lure and the appeal of Islam, because it's a very tempting and a very rich culture, which he takes a lot from as well. Most of his writings are in Arabic, right? As well as the challenge of charism. And he uses logic and he uses verses against the Karaites. He doesn't take ideas from Chazal, from the rabbis, because they're not going to be listening to that. Unfortunately, many of Rav Sadia Gaon's writings have been lost, and we don't have a lot of what he wrote against the Karaites, but we have a little bit. So first of all, he writes a poem called Esa Mishali. This is not Mishali. This is not against, it's not written to the Karaites, it's written to the Jews. So he writes, Dat Elokeinu Chalfu Linater, right? They want to take away heavenly religion. Hamutar la asorva, asur la hater. They want to permit the forbidden and forbid the permitted. Bli yirau, bli ema, without any kind of fear or awe. Lulei ha-mishnava ha-talmud asher kol zeh bam lamud, without any care for the Mishnah and the Talmud where all of this is taught. But maybe one of the most famous examples of how Rav Sadia Gaon goes against the Karaite ideas is something that's quoted. We only have it because the Ibn Ezra comes along over a century later and quotes Rav Sadia Gaon. And it's in a very, very famous verse, ayin tachan ayin, an eye for an eye, right? An eye for an eye, which of course the Karaites interpret literally and the rabbis interpret figuratively. You give the value, the monetary value of an eye. And Rav Sadia Gaon comes along and explains that the figurative is really the true interpretation because it cannot be any other way. Amar Rav Sadia, Rav Sadia says, Lo nuchal lefaresh zeha pasuk kimashmal. We cannot interpret this literally. Ki im adam hika ein chaveiro, v'sara shlishit or einav, ech yitachein shiyukam akeh kazop li tosefet umigrat. If someone hits you in the eye and you lose a third of your sight, how could you possibly do the same thing to that assailant and cause him to lose exactly that amount of sight? Ulai yechshach or eino kulo, maybe he'll go completely blind. V'yoter kasheh hakviya v'apetza v'achavura, kiim hayu b'makom misukan ulai yamut, maybe he's going to be so wounded that he might die, right? It can never be a commensurate wound. It's not possible in a physical world for that to happen. V'haklal, the rule is, lo nuchal lefaresh al derech mitzvat ha-Torah perush shalem im lo nismach al divrei chazal. We have to rely on the words of the rabbis. Ki kasher kibalnu ha-Torah min ha-avot, kein kibalnu Torah sheba'al peh. Just like we got the Torah from our ancestors, we also got the oral law. Ki ein hefresh b'neim. There is no distinction between them. There's no, not distinction, there's no separation between them. Here's the explanation of an eye for an eye. Ra'ui liyot eino tachat eino im lo yiten kaparo. Really, in a truly just universe, you should lose your eye if you take out someone's eye. But we can't do such a thing. And so you have to give your kofar, you have to give your monetary value. So it's a brilliant refutation of the Karaite idea in very simple language that everybody can understand. We'll just do one more thing about Rav Sadia and finish up the Karaites. Sorry, a little bit rushed. Okay, we have a controversy between Rav Sadia and the head of Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael, Aharon ben Meir, about the calendar. Again, this ties back to our question of who has primacy. The land of Israel should be the ones to determine the calendar, or the Babylonian Jews. And actually in 922, the Jews of Israel and the Jews of Babylonia celebrate Passover on two different dates. And ultimately they reconcile. Rav Sadia Gaon also gets into a big controversy with the Exilarch, with the Resh Galuta, David ben Zakkai, to the point where David ben Zakkai deposes Rav Sadia and appoints an alternate Gaon. Rav Sadia, not to be trifled with, deposes David ben Zakkai and appoints an alternate Exilarch. Okay? And this goes on for quite a few years until they reconcile with each other. So that's also a great story. The Karaites are unfortunately, the Jewish community and the Karaite community of Jerusalem are unfortunately decimated by the Crusader advance, 1099, the conquest of the city, right? I brought you this picture just because it was in the news recently, this amazing discovery in the Mediterranean of this perfectly preserved Crusader sword. The Karaites leave Jerusalem. They don't come back for a very long time. They go out to the diaspora, to many different places, to Egypt, to Byzantium, ultimately to Spain. And in a very fascinating twist, when the Jews are exiled from Spain, the Karaites are exiled as well, and they go in the direction of the Crimea and Lithuania. And this is a Karaite synagogue in the Crimea. And their fortunes take a very interesting turn. The Nazis don't see them as Jews, and therefore they're spared. Fascinating end of the story. But today, the world center of the Karaites is in Ramla. And that's the picture that you have over here on the right. Strong, strong Karaite community in Israel. Obviously not as strong as the Rabbinites, the Jewish community, but they have come back to the land of Israel. So let us see what questions we have. Sorry, we're a little bit rushed here, but let's go back to questions. Oh, all the way at the top. What do we have here? All right. Sorry. Chat? No, I don't care about the chats. All right. Teddy Kolek is in that picture. Yes, that's very true. Okay, sorry, I'm just scrolling to the top. Did the Jews of Muslim rule view the conquest of Jerusalem as liberation? I think we explained that. The Resh Galuta was fourth in line to the Persian monarchy. It's a very interesting idea. I will not argue with it. I do not know. Right, bodies of water, Yarchei Kala, the bride of the Jewish people. Very nice. Conservative movement used to call their retreats Kala. Okay, right. It doesn't have to be a yerach. It doesn't have to be a month. Teddy Kolek is in that picture. The mosaic artist put in a few contemporary people. Okay, Jerome wasn't so good at Hebrew because he only learned from converts. Very interesting. Thank you, Irene. The Kotel Swifts, right? Also very nice. Chat. Sorry. Al-Aqsa is the furthest place. Correct. We said that. Furthest mosque is not in Jerusalem. Well, the Saudis and they have their own issues. What happened to the exiles from the first temple? Are we talking about the 10 tribes are scattered? Yes, but the Jews of Judah and Benjamin remain the core of the Babylonian community. So it depends who you're talking about. The Samaritans Torah is essentially our Torah with a few important differences, but mostly it's the same. Okay, alternate history. Sorry, I'm not going to answer that right now, but it is interesting. Are the Karaites considered Jews in Israel? Very interesting question, Yossi. In terms of marriage, I believe they have to convert, although I'm not 100% sure. I know that when they serve in the army, they get special dispensation because of their Shabbat is different and they claim they can't keep Shabbat in the army, so they have to be able to go home. Are they allowed to marry? It's a great question. I don't know. I can look into it. Hey, the Karaite synagogue in Jerusalem is in the Old City. It's in the Jewish quarter. It's give or take 1,000 years old. How can you have Yiddishkeit without cholent? No wonder they are almost extinct. I see some strong cholent advocates. Chicken and milk, I do not believe that. Actually, that's not true. I think they do have that. They don't hold by the extension of basar v'chalav to include chicken. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure. Okay. Yes, mikvah, we do not have in First Temple times. Professor Lukshin discussed the comment of Rashbam. Thank you. That's very interesting. Kashrut also, like we said, basar v'chalav issues different. Okay. It's Rav Amram Gaon, but Rav Amram Gaon is only slightly before Sadia, and Sadia is considered to be like a full Sidur. Right. Fayum. He's a Fayumi. Right. And he says Fayum is the location of Pitom. Very nice. I did not know that. Right. The Nazis asked if the Karaites are Jews, and the Karaites were saved by the fact that the rabbi saved them, said they weren't Jews. Correct. Do they meet requirements for the law of return? I am sure they do, because there are many, many Karaites who came back in the 1940s and 50s, in the late 40s and the 50s. Right. When the rabbinites also pick and choose. Everybody picks and chooses. Is there a biography of Rav Sadia? Is there a biography, Rabbi Kalman? Do you know of a biography of Rav Sadia?
I was just looking at my list of all my biographies. Yeah, I don't the Babylonian of Babylonia and the shaping medieval Jewish culture. That's not a Rav Sadia. I think there is. I don't know if I have it. This book by Brody, you know, Robert, he's the expert on the Gona period. does he have a whole chapter on Rav Sadia? I don't know. Have to look. I'll ask Mark Shapiro. I'm sure he'll know. I can't think offhand.
If you want to get started, though, there's an excellent article about him in the Encyclopedia Judaica. I would look on Wikipedia, too. People look down on Wikipedia, but it has a lot of good information. There might be something in the introduction to Sefer Emunot V'Deot, but I don't know offhand. But that's good. Ask Rabbi Shapiro, see what he can suggest for us.
I'll look into that. Thank you. Okay, thank you, Shula. Go enjoy, prepare for Sheva Brachas. Thank you very much. Okay, tonight, 8:30 Eastern, if you're up cooking, I shouldn't say that. I'm sorry. If you're up at 3:30 in the morning, you can listen Rivki Freundlich tonight on Ma'aseh Avot Siman Le'imahot. Rivka as Abraham too. Sounds like a fascinating topic, actually. Masei Avot Siman Imahot. That's at 8:30. Rivki Freundlich is a Yoetzet Halacha working. She's living in Montreal where, and tomorrow morning, my shiur on the Siddur, closer look at Siddur, 9:30 a.m. And then, next week, our 9 regular schedule shiurim. Shuli's class next week, as I mentioned in a couple of the other classes, will be at 1 p.m. Eastern time next week, because Israel changes the clock on Saturday night. We in North America do not. So not every class, Shuli's class and Rav Carmel's class will be given according to Israel time. So 8:15 in Israel Wednesday, that's 2:15 here in the afternoon Wednesday, and 1 p.m. here in Chutz Laaretz, and 7 p.m. in Israel. The Monday and Tuesday shirim, Dr. Guhartz and Rachel Danziger, their shirim will go according to Eastern time. In other words, they'll both be at 11 a.m. It'll be 3 p.m. in England and 5 p.m. in Israel. So that's split personalities next week. That's just for 1 week until we change the clock. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful day. We hope to see you tonight, tomorrow, all times. Invite your friends. That's the cost of admission, even though we don't charge it, but that's the cost. And encourage other people. Let them try a class. And always interested to hear your feedback, positive, negative. And okay, and any ways to make it even better to do what we're doing. Okay, we look forward to learning with you. And Mazel Tov again, Shuli, and enjoy the rest of the week in the Sheva Brachas, and everything should be well for, we should have many occasions to celebrate.
Amen. Thank you. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Be well, everybody.